Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network for this Monday, the 19th of December. We cover a lot of territory with Professor Julian Zelizer for All Things Political, so we will cover a lot this hour. And there's a lot going on. The death of Kim Jong-il we will talk about during the course of this hour. The Iowa caucuses, just a couple weeks away now. This big debate about extending the payroll tax cut for 2 months, it seems to be very much up in the air today, as is an extension of unemployment benefits. And what about this pipeline that's attached to this? What's going on? Are people going to see their taxes go up come January? Well, our guest also has advice for the Democrats on how they should conduct their presidential campaign because the economy is not good. President Obama's approval ratings are not very high. So what would be a good issue for them? And what can the Democrats learn from these many debates that the Republicans have had? Those are just a few of the issues that are on the table this hour. And you are welcome to join the conversation with whatever you'd like. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Professor Julian Zelizer is one of our favorite guests, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of many books that examine U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions since the New Deal. He's written several books on presidents, including Jimmy Carter, Conservatives in Power, the Reagan Years, 1981 to 1989. He's written a book on George W. Bush, the first historical assessment, and he is the author of The Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. His latest book, Governing America, The Revival of Political History, which will be out soon if it isn't already. And he's a very well-known commentator in the national and international television, radio, and print media. He writes a weekly column for CNN.com. Professor Zelizer, thank you so much for being with us again. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We have a lot to talk about today. Let's start with this payroll tax cut, which seems to be quite up in the air. Are taxes going up in January?
Well, they might. The Senate thought they reached a deal. Harry Reid thought that he and Mitch McConnell finally had a way to at least extend this for a couple months. But the House Republicans, again, being pushed to the right by the Tea Party and being pushed away from any kind of compromise, are now saying they won't support it. And so it's very likely that the payroll tax holiday could come to an end and taxes could go up, unless, of course, there's some kind of last-minute deal in this ongoing game of brinksmanship that we see on Capitol Hill.
How can they accomplish a last-minute deal when the Senate has left town?
It's very difficult. Obviously, senators can be called back in rather dramatic fashion. I think a lot of Republicans in the Senate are very nervous about the implications of allowing the taxes to or the tax cut to expire and unemployment benefits not be extended right going into the holiday break. But we'll see what happens. I think the Republicans are starting to divide over how far to take their stand on fiscal policy. And there's tensions emerging within the party, not just between the parties.
Mm-hmm. The president said, I recall a couple of weeks ago, that he would not let anybody leave until this issue was resolved.
Well, that didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen.
President Obama has often kind of drawn a line in the sand, and it hasn't really done much. The Republicans don't really care about that. And they feel even with some of the gains that Obama's made in recent weeks, with some improvement in the economy, just a little, that they still, have him where they want him, and that in the end, he doesn't follow through on many threats that he makes to the GOP.
And what about the extension of unemployment benefits, Professor Zelizer? Are those out the window, too?
Oh, I don't know. I think everyone watching Washington is unclear what's going to happen. This took people by surprise. It shouldn't have, but I think there was a sense the House Republicans would go along with the deal. It accomplished a lot of what the Republicans wanted. It would have forced President Obama to deal with this pipeline issue and make a decision, and it would have kind of brought the whole debate back in a couple months, which is a strategy Republicans have loved. They temporarily deal with an issue and then force the president to fight it out within a few months. You know, not extending unemployment benefits can be very damaging for the Republican Party, and it obviously could be damaging for many Americans who are depending on those. So we'll see. Everything's in the air this morning on Washington.
Mm-hmm. The bill also includes this provision for requiring the president to issue a permit for this oil pipeline. Why is that in the bill?
Well, it's been a big problem for the president. Many Republicans and Democrats want this pipeline on the grounds it will create jobs and help the economy. Environmental groups have been dead set against this. It led to protests in Washington that caused the president a lot of problems, that this would have a detrimental effect on the environment. And for many environmentalists, they saw this as a litmus test. Is this president serious about the kind of environmental issues he talked about in 2008 but hasn't done that much about since then? And so by forcing him to say something, it's not just about getting something the Republicans want. It's about causing problems with him and the Democratic base. This is an issue the president hasn't dealt with very effectively, and they don't want to let him postpone this until after the election. They want to force him to say something now.
I recall that this was a pipeline that initially he may have been for, and then the lobbying on the part of environmental groups was so effective that he changed his mind.
That's exactly what happened, and by all indications that we have, you know, this, it's called the Keystone XL oil sands pipeline, was something the president was ready to go forward with, and it was a case where the activism of the left had an effect. The environmental groups were very forceful. They didn't only come to Washington, but they got this story in the media and made it clear that it would have very detrimental effects, and then the president backed off. I assume it's primarily for political reasons, although perhaps he was persuaded by their arguments if he hadn't heard them already. But it was one of these issues that created, it was like the public option during health care, that just opened up a lot of tensions that are there with liberal Democrats who feel the president, you know, hasn't really followed through on many of his promises.
Mm-hmm. But the bill does include this provision requiring him to issue the permit for this pipeline. So he changed his mind again on it?
We don't know what's going on, but behind the scenes. But yes, this kind of flips him back to where he started, at least partially, and would allow some progress on the pipeline, and again force the issue to be resolved.
Hmm. Well, hard to believe those Iowa caucuses are just a couple weeks away now. What a wild ride this has been for the Republicans.
Well, it's hard to believe because it feels like the campaign started a long time ago.
Yeah.
And it's not just that everything started early and that there's organizing and fundraising early, as we've seen in other elections, but it's been nationally televised. The Republicans have had many debates. People have seen candidates rise or fall before any vote is taken. And it's been a very visible part of the news if you're following it. And so this is an interesting Iowa caucus, and it comes after this pre-campaign that we've had. And some of the people who might have been surprise victors in Iowa or New Hampshire are already out. They've already stepped out, or there's little hope for them. And we have this two-person race and one sleeper, Huntsman, going into Iowa, where the stakes are very high in terms of how these first rounds of voting go.
Mm-hmm. So is it still true, as it was some months ago, that the strongest candidate that the Republicans could run against the president is Mitt Romney?
I think it still is, and I think, you know, the rise of Newt Gingrich in recent weeks has shaken the confidence of some Romney supporters. But by many indications, he still remains the most formidable Republican. He's been the most steady throughout this screening process that we've had. He still has raised a lot of money and polls pretty well in general election polls, which I think this year a lot of Republicans are looking at, and it's given pause to some of the enthusiasm for Newt Gingrich, meaning not how they'll do in the primary, but how will they do against President Obama. He still has that economics background, business background, which is very attractive, and the same kind of middle-of-the-road, flip-flop centrism, whatever you'd like to call it, which right now isn't appealing to many Republican activists in a general campaign, could make it difficult for Obama to tag him as one kind of Republican or another. So I still think he comes out of these months of debates as the strongest candidate, or positioned to still defeat Newt Gingrich and take on the president.
And please tell me why you think Newt Gingrich has been enjoying such popularity.
Well, part of it is the same story we've seen with Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry. There is some unease with Mitt Romney or lack of enthusiasm, so the Republicans are constantly searching for the next thing, the next best potential candidate. Part of it is the media. I mean, I don't think it's simply voter. I think reporters are drawn to an interesting story, and a story about Mitt Romney doing relatively well or hanging in there and being steady isn't very exciting. The rise and fall of these opponents, I think, plays very well. It makes it more interesting, and I think that's helped. And finally, Newt Gingrich is a skilled politician. Unlike some of the other challengers to Romney, he's not a lightweight. He's someone who helped the Republicans regain the House of Representatives, and he's a mix of a politician with big ideas who is also a politician who can play hardball politics, you know, with the best of them. And so in some ways, I think it was, you know, observers who underestimated the idea that if he was disciplined, Gingrich could give Mitt Romney a run for the money and appeal to some Republicans who are still searching for the next Ronald Reagan.
Hmm. He has this very unusual style. He is, to a lot of people's minds, a fairly arrogant guy who compares himself to some of the big leaders of the world. And there's something that is off-putting to many people, but other people must find that attractive in some way. Is there any historical comparison when you look at Newt Gingrich and how he thinks of himself?
I'd have to think about it. I mean, the kind of arrogance is something that's not unique to him. Most politicians are arrogant, and it's a matter of how much they show it. And it takes a certain amount of arrogance to do this, to tell the country they want to be the next leader. Some people said that about Bill Clinton, very smart, you know, amazing handle of issues and willingness to engage in the big debates. And I remember in 92 there was some discussion, you know, that you know, he thought a lot of himself. And it doesn't necessarily hurt a politician in the end. I think it can be attractive. I think people like someone who thinks of themselves as a winner. That's part of how Newt Gingrich has moved forward. Doesn't care what the media says or what even some polls say. He believes he should be the president, and it's that belief that ultimately can be very powerful on the campaign trail. There was some of that in President Obama. I mean, as a candidate, people talked about an aloofness and also an arrogance, but others found that compelling. He believed he could beat Hillary Clinton, and he did.
Mm-hmm. And finally, before we go to phone calls, this is a big unknown, but I wonder what people in Washington are, what kinds of meetings are taking place to talk about who in the world is this guy who's going to be running North Korea now, and what are we in for?
It's big news on the international front. North Korea's always been, like Iran, a country that is creating a lot of tensions in the U.S. about how do we handle the country, how do we deal with, in North Korea, the nuclear power and now instability in the government, and not just instability, but a real unknown about who follows. He's loomed larger than life and has been a really big figure on the international scene, and I think a lot of Washington policymakers are not sure what comes next, what the government will look like. There doesn't seem to be a lot of optimism of internal change or some kind of reform as we saw in the Soviet Union. But I think in the realm of foreign policy, everyone has their eye on North Korea, but no one knows exactly what they're looking at right now.
Yeah. You read about this and you go, oh my gosh, North Koreans are told he graduated from Kim Il-sung Military University, speaks several foreign languages, including English, is a whiz at computing and technology. However, his birth date, his marital status, and even the name of his mother, said to be Kim Jong-il's late second wife, are all secrets.
Yeah, the public doesn't know much there or here, and they know about the personas, but they don't know about the people, and that's how, you know, dictatorial systems work, and they keep that secret for a reason, and I think it keeps people uneasy or unstable in terms of how to react when these governments emerge.
Every Monday at 9, we do All Things Political. Our guest is Professor Julian Zelizer, this hour professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books. He's quite a presidential scholar as well. Our phone number, and we have a couple lines open if you'd like to grab it right away, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, we already have some of those coming in, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Mark Durr will be with us. His latest book is How the Dog Became the Dog, From Wolves to Our Best Friends, a fact you can carry into discussions today. The oldest dog remains on record, found in Belgium recently, 31,700 years ago. How about that? Let's go to phone calls. Matt in Fond du Lac. Hi, Matt.
Yes, good morning. I'm enjoying your discussion here. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add a little bit. You touched on the point about the XL pipeline, and it definitely was the environmentalist that hundreds of arrests outside the White House that was the most visible resistance to that and put most pressure on the president. But also apparently there was huge resistance in Nebraska, which is not known as a real blue state. My understanding was that that corporation sponsored something before a Nebraska football game as it was announced, and they were booed.
So oh, really?
There was huge resistance to that going across the Sand Hill region in Nebraska. Just that I'd enlarge that a little bit for you.
I didn't hear about the boos. I did hear about the Nebraska issue and the resistance from Nebraska, which goes beyond just the grassroots movement. So, there you have electoral politics mixing with movement activism, and it's put President Obama in a big bind, and that's why the Republicans are delighted in this deal. I think they really want to force this issue on him, and they want to get the pipeline built. They want the best of both of those worlds, it's been a sleeper issue that's created a lot of tension for this president.
And it brings to mind the support that the president may be losing come the next election. He, of course, was counting on the environmental vote, other kinds of progressive vote for the last election. Are people going to sit out this election if he changes his mind and makes a kind of compromise on this pipeline?
Well, I don't think if he compromises on the pipeline, he loses the election because of that. But I think the administration is correctly looking at a campaign that can be very close if the Republicans pick the right kind of a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they need is, especially in swing states, Democratic-leaning organizations to be willing to go out, to organize, to get people to the voting booth. And those organizations are crucial to elections. And they're nervous and worried that, if they compromise too much on some core issues, these groups just won't be that enthusiastic. And so it's the closeness of the campaign is raising the stakes in these kind of issues. There was a long time when the administration just assumed they had the environmental groups, the unions, and that they would come out no matter what in 2012. That was the mentality I think they had for many years. Why would they ever vote for a Republican?
Right.
They're not going to. But the question is if they come out at all.
We go next. Thank you very much, Matt, for your call. Let's go to Bill next on the road. Hi, Bill.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. One of the things that puzzled me about the Democratic Party is why they don't take some of the red meat that exists in the past of Mitt Romney. For example, he got rich by starting a company whose main function was buying up profitable companies and getting controlling shares, and then he would run up the share price by laying off workers, closing plants, outsourcing to China and India or any place he could where he could get the lowest possible prices for labor and materials. Then when the share price was run up, you know, for maximum profitability, then he would break the companies up and sell them off piecemeal and pocket the profits. And basically, he got rich by the most predatory, most amoral form of capitalism.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, you can bet that those stories have floated, and his history has floated, of what Bain Capital did and what Romney was doing. You know, the administration doesn't want to put out everything right now. Right now, the whole game is to send out a few attacks, especially about the flip-flopper issue, and wait for the Republicans to beat up on themselves. Those kind of issues would be a major theme of a fall campaign. The administration will do everything possible to tag Mitt Romney to the kind of financial and business institutions that Americans are unhappy with. You know, Mike Huckabee, a former Republican candidate, once joked that Mitt Romney looks like the guy who fired you. And I think that's the argument in some ways that the administration will make. But it's tricky because many people are upset that the administration has been so close to Wall Street, that they bailed out or supported the TARP bailout. And there's arguments that the Republicans can make from the right where they could throw those arguments back against the president, although obviously his background was very different. He's now in a different position. So that's all coming. That would be the fall campaign against Mitt Romney if he's the nominee, but I don't think it would be always very smooth for the administration.
Thank you, Bill. Here's an email from Jerry Ann in Milwaukee regarding the Iowa caucus. I don't understand all the fuss over it. It seems meaningless to me. It isn't even a vote. Just whoever in this small state with no electoral clout shows up shuffling from one corner of a room to another, and it doesn't seem to predict anything. Last year, for instance, Huckabee, not McCain, was the so-called winner. Does the professor know what the track record is for presidential candidates who participate in that caucus?
I don't know offhand, but you have many examples such as that. You know, you also have that in New Hampshire, where people rise early on, do very well, and then ultimately lose out as the vote count accumulates through the other primaries. You know, the Iowa caucus was irrelevant until 1976, and it was then that Jimmy Carter turned a rather, you know, eccentric or odd process into something that had national importance. And he saw other candidates weren't running there, and he realized if he organized and his team spent a lot of time there, he could use an early victory to propel himself, to look like the front runner. That was the whole game. If you win once, you're more likely to win the next one because all of a sudden reporters will say you're more serious than we thought and you're capable of a victory. But in the long run, often that doesn't turn out to be the case. And I think Romney's campaign knows this, Gingrich's campaign knows this. They need to win in Florida. They need to win in some of the other states going down. And this will probably go right down to the convention. So Iowa will be important. It will be notable. But I don't think it's going to determine the Republican.
The same was true for Barack Obama 4 years ago in Iowa.
Absolutely. And, you know, the lesson of the his campaign was that you need to look at the long race and the delegate count overall. You're trying to get enough delegates. You're not trying to have a blowout or surprise victory in one of the early primaries. It helps, but it doesn't mean, you know, this is who will gain the nomination.
Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I'm concerned about, you know, what this represents with this Keystone pipeline being included in this extension of the tax benefits for most working people. Is that that's part of the problem, I think, with our current democracy is not only the influence of money, but the way that they stick in like these little poison pills into bills, and just how everything, you know, you get something good and you get something really bad, and it's all bundled into one package, and then it's used for political influence. But and because of the Citizens United case, this is also playing out in Wisconsin, and I think it's already becoming more and more of a problem. Basically, you're saying the people with the most money have the most democracy. They have the most voice. They have the most influence. And the big myth about this domestic oil production is, although it might create some jobs, the oil belongs to multinational corporations. It's not America's oil. That would be socialism. it belongs to private corporations. I don't think it's going to influence the price of oil. It's only going to make the whole problem of global climate change worse, because we're not addressing the real problem. We're just, it's following this let's burn the last stick in the forest type of mentality, and I don't think that's good for anyone.
There's three points in the call. One is that will the pipeline have the economic effects promised? And many environmental groups have questioned that. Non-environmental groups have questioned that, where the money will actually go and will the jobs actually come. So I do think that's a big part of the critique of the proposal. A second is the kind of log rolling that you see with this. I would have to say this isn't unique to current times, and it's not always about money. This is how Congress works. You kind of trade provisions and include things in bills to win over, you know, people who have nothing to do with the major part of the legislation, just to get the votes. You know, Lyndon Johnson in 1957 supported a water project in the West in order to get votes he needed for a civil rights bill. And so you see this historically. This is how the institution works. We might not like it, but it's how it works. The third part gets us back to a theme that Obama emphasized in 2008, but has moved very far away from: campaign finance reform and the political process. There was an argument that he made and others made, unless you change the process, the basic policies won't change. Money is very powerful in Washington. K Street is, some people say, as influential as Capitol Hill. And if you don't deal with those core questions about how democracy works, you're going to get the same outcomes. And you're talking about marginal differences in policy, but money will always win out. I don't know if President Obama really can make much of an issue of that anymore. He is now part of that system, and he hasn't really done much to change it. But I think it does raise a big question, something we need to look at. How can we deal and reform a political process that, for many Americans, is broken?
Mm. You wrote a piece for CNN where you do your weekly column recently, asking this question. You say, as Democrats struggle to retain control of the Senate and retake control of the House, they're searching for issues to frame their campaigns. This isn't easy, since the Democrats are in a difficult position. You talk about Obama's low approval rating and the economy still likely to be in not very tip-top condition. So what might the Democrats talk about?
Yeah, I was trying to think that through and work that through, and there is a basic issue of fairness. Fairness in terms of how you deal with a sluggish economy. Not will you magically have economic recovery, but while we're in this period, the Democrats could make a very old argument for the party, that Republicans promote policies that are beneficial to wealthier Americans, and they don't have a sense of fairness in terms of who should pay the price or who should bear the burden for getting through these hard times. You know, Democrats in the 1930s, when FDR was president, talked about this kind of issue. One historian said they searched for a kind of moral capitalism. They were in favor of the free market system, but you needed institutions like unions and policies like regulation to make sure that workers were treated fairly in that system. In 1982, in midterm elections, Democrats really did well on this issue. They talked about fairness in the economy and argued that Ronald Reagan, the president, was promoting policies for upper-income taxpayers and corporations. And Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, you know, made speeches all around the country that what Democrats were for was fairness. And Republicans are often handing them this issue. If they block this deal right now, they've just increased payroll taxes for middle-class Americans and cut unemployment benefits for many who are in need. And that's just one example that congressional Democrats can run on and say, you know, we'll offer you a very different approach that deals with what does the middle class deserve as they struggle through these hard times.
Scott in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Good morning. Your guest actually probably just answered my question. I was kind of curious as to what his thought was on the way 2012 campaign will run. I mean, if you look at 28, it's got to be completely different. I mean, you had a candidate in Barack Obama who, I mean, Evan Thomas said he was godlike. You had Time Magazine calling him the one. I mean, you had press outlets and people saying that he was unlike any candidate they've ever seen before. And now after 3 years, he's just another Paul. I mean, the pipeline is a perfect example. You know, he was for it, now he's against it, but So how does he run completely different from who he was in 2008, from this godlike character that the press made him out to be to just another average politician?
It's extraordinarily difficult, and to come back to the Carter comparison, Carter faced some of that in 1980. He, too, in 76, was seen as this very different kind of politician, not part of the Washington system, would change everything and really make a new kind of politics in Washington. And by 1980, he was just one member of that very same system that seemed broken, and he lost the ability to run on that. And Carter faced Ronald Reagan, who took this theme from them, from the Democratic Party. So he can't talk about that. He has a difficult time he's going to have talking about some of his policies, because some are unpopular, like health care. And on the economy, unless the economy's recovered, he can say everything he wants about the stimulus package and others, financial regulation, but it will ring hollow for many Americans who are still suffering through very high unemployment rates. So he's going to have to really craft out a pragmatic vision for the next 4 years, and to really eviscerate in some ways what the Republicans would do. He'll have to talk about fairness, not just in terms of what he's done, but lay out a set of policies that he will pursue in the next few years within this same political system, and characterize Republicans as extremists. And so that's really the only option he has. He can't go back to being the hero who's going to come in and save Washington. I think that will be a hard sell for many.
Is there anything he can do, considering the incredible partisanship now in Washington, that would help the economy recover soon?
It's unclear. I mean, some would argue even if the partisanship wasn't there, there's limits on what the government could do. You're dealing with structural issues like jobs fleeing to other parts of the world. It depends who you ask. For many Democrats, a big stimulus package, even with the deficit, is ultimately what you need. Others would argue you need certain kinds of long-term investments in infrastructure to create incentives to have the new Silicon Valley, to create the products of the future, and to deal with everything from transportation to research, so that we're not just kind of going in circles all the time, and we're thinking about the next 10, 15 years. But will that work? Congress right now can't even pass routine bills. Everything is high stakes, brinksmanship politics, and the House Republicans will not accept anything this president does, and they won't in the next 4 years. It will only get worse if they still have control of the House, because they'll be thinking of 2016, and they have fundamental disagreements right now with the Democrats. So I don't think the chances of big legislation are very high in the next 4 years. And so he's going to have to pull a Bill Clinton. He's going to have to talk about very middle-of-the-road, small-scale policies that he thinks would still be helpful, and sell them as something bigger in some ways.
But what about the American people? Haven't we reached a point where we're just saying, for heaven's sake, do something? We're reaching a breaking point here.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. People feel that way, but people don't always vote that way. If you have high rates of incumbency, which we still do, there's no reason for politicians to really change their ways. Ultimately, voters do have power, even with private money, even with the limits that of political participation. If you vote politicians out of office in large numbers, they get scared, and the new people might come in with new ideas. So if we have high rates of incumbency, as sick as many Americans are, it's unlikely you'll have big changes in the political system.
Thanks, Scott, for your call. Dwayne in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. Enjoy listening to your show. I just had a couple comments. I ran a machine for 30 years mailing medical statements and watched these medical bills just climb, and to the point where you could have a procedure done that would, if you didn't have insurance, would financially ruin you for your whole life. I mean, 4 hours on an operating table and the bills of $250,000 if you didn't have insurance. That's one thing I think that's driving the cost. And when I was growing up, my dad had a mortgage. Mom stayed home, six kids. He worked at a meatpacking company, made a good living. A lot of those jobs are gone. Now, people will basically, you can have a second mortgage by your health insurance premiums. It'll be up there with a mortgage payment, the same amount of money, you know, and people won't be able to afford health insurance. They're really, the socioeconomic classes are, the divide is getting huge, and people won't be able to save for retirement. But I honestly think health care is driving a lot of the problems we're having right now.
Yeah, health care costs have been going up, and they were a driving force behind the reform that President Obama was able to pass early in his presidency. It's, you know, really unclear whether that reform will be effective in curbing costs. The president made many compromises during the congressional debate that severely weakened the cost-cutting measures that, you know, originally were in the package. And now things such as the mandate are up for review by the Supreme Court. You know, unless you bring a lot of people into the health insurance system, the private health care system won't become much cheaper. And so something has to be done. Some Democrats and Republicans are looking at Medicare reform. Others will likely call for a new round of health care reform at some point to deal with costs. But this is the secret tax many Americans are facing every year. And it's something that the politicians have not really been able to curb.
Thanks, Twain. Christine in Madison, hi.
Hi. I wanted to sort of make a comment about the Ogallala Aquifer, which the pipeline is an issue. Having grown up on the plains of Nebraska, where the aquifer is so important, there years ago the farmers fought irrigation for dryland farming because they were concerned about the aquifer, and the water level has gone down. So I think this isn't just an environmentalist issue. That aquifer supplies clean water to millions and millions of people. And unless they know and have some way of controlling pollution, if that pipeline breaks, polluting that aquifer would be a real disaster. And I think people need to see this as not just an environmental fight, but a lot of ordinary people who live in the sand hills in Nebraska are really very much concerned about that aquifer.
And how? What do you think about how this has been handled politically, Christine?
I don't think that people are getting the whole information about how important that the aquifer is as important to people in Nebraska and the plains as the Gulf is to people in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And they really need to understand that pollution of that aquifer can affect farmers, people in cities, and a whole lot of people. And so I think we shouldn't just be talking, oh, the environmentalists versus this. It's really a matter of people's life, quality of life in mm-hmm. that area of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me that we talked a little bit about this earlier, but, you know, the opponents of the pipeline question whether the pipeline will bring the kinds of jobs that have been promised. The whole aquifer Nebraska argument also reminds us about the very, you know, real impact this pipe, negative consequences the pipeline could have on key parts of the country. I think the State Department had a report, you know, arguing this was still safe and it was the most economically feasible path, but many people have obviously disagreed with that and have not bought into that State Department report. But this is just, again, another reminder of the kind of problems this pipeline has caused, and why it's not a surprise the Republicans want to talk about this as much as possible right now.
Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest for All Things Political this Monday, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, you can use that if you don't have access to a phone or don't want to use the phone, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, the author of How the Dog Became the Dog, From Wolves to Our Best Friends. Back to phone calls for Professor Julian Zelizer, John in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. My question was in regards to the Grover Norquist and his credibility in the media and how he seems to be almost deified. If I remember correctly, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, there was a scandal that involved Jack Abramoff and Ralph Reed and Grover Norquist, and it was concerning, if I remember correctly, it was some lobbying money from the casinos in, I don't know, Oklahoma or someplace, and they were laundering the money, and it seems like since then Jack Abramoff has been disgraced and Ralph Reed has kind of disappeared from the scene, but the media doesn't seem to remind us about Grover Norquist, and I'm curious as to why that might be.
That's a very good point. He was implicated in that scandal, which brought down so many Republicans and one of the most powerful lobbyists on Capitol Hill. A little, I guess part of it is he's outside of the public radar, even though this tax pledge he forced many Republicans or pressured many Republicans to agree to is very public. You know, he's not the kind of figure many people follow. But he was part of this very illicit network of lobbying and campaign contributors that just a few years ago, back in 2006, was one of the biggest stories in Washington. Norquist is a skillful political operator. He's not an elected official, but he's really helped to shape Republican politics since the 1980s, and he's done a good job, more than many other Republicans, after that scandal broke at distancing himself enough from the story so that right now it doesn't come up. But most, again, who follow this, either consumers of news or reporters, are more focused on the tax pledge than on Norquist himself. And if Norquist was discredited, I'm not sure it would fundamentally change the political dynamics, meaning it's this opposition to taxes which goes much further than the pledge. It's a core issue for Republicans. It's the anti-communism of current times that's really the issue here. So the story is, it is true, but I think those are the reasons it doesn't damage him that much.
Hmm. Thank you, John, very much. Let's go to Rich in Blair. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
I'm wondering why we never hear them bring up the war on drugs. It seems to me that that's an important issue to a lot of America, as well as the rest of the world. It's the longest war we've ever fought. It's against the American people. Thousands of people die in Mexico annually as a result of this war. We have things like Operation Fast and Furious, which the DEA initiated, and now the ATF is taking the blame for. I'd like to know why our government continues a war that has failed so miserably.
There's many who join that criticism, certainly on some of the quote-unquote softer drugs like marijuana, and this has been an argument that you have seen certainly since the 1980s when President Reagan accelerated the war on drugs, that it was an ineffective war. It didn't deal with the core public health problems, and in some ways it fuels the problem. It creates an illegal market, which is quite devastating to urban communities and does very little about drug use and demand, which the war on poverty is never, I mean the war on drugs has never been as focused on. Supporters say it's a war that will never have a victory, but it's one that you still have to fight. That the damage of drugs such as heroin and meth and cocaine are severe, and that the government it's a futile war, but constantly trying to curb the inflow of the drugs is important. It's something most politicians don't want to touch. President Obama has reversed some of the liberalization of marijuana that we've seen in the states and taken a harder line than many people suspected. It's still symbolically an issue that many liberals are certainly scared to talk about. Many libertarian conservatives are not putting up front and center, and many in the rest of the party still want to be in favor of this and help position themselves as being on the right side of the culture wars.
Thanks, Rich. And we have another Rich. Isn't that ironic? From Appleton. Hi, Rich.
Hello. Good
Hi.
Morning. This is probably, I won't say maybe definitely on topic, but I think it might be the underlying problem. And I did do some looking into the version of the Webster's Dictionary from 1971 that I've got this part from, as opposed to the new one, which is quite a bit softer. But the quote from the 7th edition Webster's Dictionary about politics, the first one is, "the art or science concerned with guiding or influencing governmental policy." Number two, "the art or science concerned with winning and holding control over a government." Number three, "political life, a principal activity or profession wherein lies the problem." And finally, "it's political activities characterized by artful and often dishonest practices." So I'm just taking this all the way back to the beginning. I think this is where a lot of our problem lies. Money, number one, we all know that. And number two is they're treating this like an absolute profession that they cannot lose, no matter what the cost.
Those are fair criticisms. I'd say the thing we have to think about is that when many of those forces have been at work before, the system can produce legislation. It can produce results. Money was important in the 1960s, and politicians were, you know, very focused on keeping office. And then you had the Great Society, same during the 1930s. So I don't think politics is inherently broken in this country, or it has to be this way. We have more than enough examples when the system can have moments of great productivity and great innovation. Even for conservatives, you could argue with deregulation and tax cuts in the 70s and 80s, the system moved forward. I do think, again, as we said earlier, this problem of money and politics is a very important one that we have to deal with. The problems of partisan polarization, and how do you diminish some of that on Capitol Hill or create countervailing forces? You don't eliminate it ever. How do we do that? How do we change the political system to achieve that? And finally, it's a question of leadership. And can we find effective leaders who can find those points of commonality? The polls show the public isn't as divided as our politicians. Very often on many issues, the disagreement is not as great as you'd think if you're just watching the news. And so it will take great leaders, too, to figure out, you know, and have the courage to push for those key points. So I think the system's not inherently broken, and I think some of those problems have been overcome in the past.
Thank you, Rich. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, hi. What I'd like to talk about is thinking deficiencies that I see in people, which are manifested in the inability to connect the dots and to see how what our views in one area are, and then what our actions in another area are. So, for example, in politics, what we see happening in the society is that we, and especially here in Wisconsin, we see cuts inflicted on the poor and the middle class, cutbacks on Badger care, for example, for health, and also, you know, this idea that you're not going to get any welfare if you're out of work if for some reason you have a drug problem. If you test, you have to be tested to see if you've used drugs, and if you use drugs, of course, you don't qualify for welfare. Now, contrast this, for example, with some of the things that we do ostensibly, because we're ostensibly committed to the Christmas spirit and working against Scrooge. We're encouraged this time of the year to give to food drives, to contribute to the Salvation Army, and to take to give gifts off the giving tree at our church for the poor. So we do that on the one hand, but then on the other hand, we vote for people that support measures that attack the poor. So we have this inability to connect the dots and to see that our behaviors are inconsistent. Also, in the black culture, they celebrate Kwanzaa, which and one of the principles of Kwanzaa is that is giving back, so that I is a basic responsibility I have, and that I should offer a helping hand to others, which is a manifestation of love your neighbor as yourself, which is a key priority in the Bible. So we're not consistent. We're like the poor. We share Christian values with the poor, but we don't, in our actions, we support them on the one hand at Christmas, but then we attack them the rest of the year.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, look, yes, the electorate is very inconsistent on many issues. American society has always been inconsistent in terms of our public policies, in terms of our public attitudes. We often do one thing abroad or here in the United States, and something very different a few days earlier. The problem of inequality has been a big one in American politics since the 70s. By every measure, inequality has been growing. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing. And unless we do something about that, combined with some of the structural economic problems we face, we can talk about poverty, we can focus on charity, but some of the underlying economic tensions and problems won't go away. And I think there's room for one of the parties to really try to deal with this and try to offer solutions and a reversal of the economic trends that we've seen for a while. But we are often very inconsistent, for sure, in how we talk about these things.
Mm-hmm. Professor Zelizer, always a great pleasure to have you on the air. I hope you have a great holiday season, and we'll look forward to talking to you as the political presidential year gets really going come January.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks. Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. He's our guest frequently on All Things Political. And he does all kinds of media work. He writes for CNN.com, a weekly column. He has published over 200 op-eds. He's published in the Newsweek, Politico, New York Times, Washington Post, Daily Beast, Salon, Huffington Post, LA Times, Boston Globe, and The American Prospect. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios, where it's 40 degrees, for heaven's sake. It's pretty warm. We're going to talk about dogs. Stay with us. That's coming up very soon here on the Ideas Network.